Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Later in the hour, Provincetown Jazz Festival founder Bart Wiseman joins us to discuss the lineup for this year's festival, and we'll hear some tracks from the featured artists. But first, the importance of home ownership in the accumulation of generational wealth and sense of belonging can't be overstated. Historically, in the U.S., race has been used to decide who can and cannot own real estate. Despite these racist practices, there are many places in the country where Black people did acquire and retain property. Martha's Vineyard is one of those places. A new book explains the factors that set Martha's Vineyard apart and tells the stories of families who've returned to their summer homes for generations. The book is titled Black Home Ownership and Martha's Vineyard, A History. And with us are the co-authors, Richard Lewis Taylor and Tom Dresser. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning, and thanks for having us.
So, Richard, you're a longtime seasonal resident of the Vineyard, a lawyer and a real estate developer, and author of Martha's Vineyard, Race, Property, and the Power of Place. When did you meet Tom, and how did you come to collaborate on this book?
Well, Tom is really very well known on the island and has written quite a few books, over 10 actually, around various parts of the history of the island, and he wrote a book about African Americans. I read the book. I thought it was very well done. And we had seen each other around. And so I knocked on his door one day and sat on his porch and said, "Hey, Tom, I have an idea that we could possibly collaborate on." And that began the conversation 2 years ago.
All right. So, Tom, when did Black Americans first start coming to the Vineyard and what brought them there originally?
Well, if you trace things way back, I mean, the first slaves were coming to Virginia in 1619, and there were slaves on Martha's Vineyard in the 1600s and 1700s, but they were a very small number, and many were had escaped slavery, and so that was just the beginning. But the real numbers of Blacks started to come after the Civil War. They came as servants and home helpers and babysitters, and they helped white families. They came to Martha's Vineyard with white families, and they started to earn money, and they saw that the vineyard was a very enjoyable place and an inviting place. And they were, some of them were able to buy property here. And that's really the beginning of the African-American movement on the vineyard.
One of the first Black vineyarders to own a home was Reverend Jackson, who bought his home in 1871. Richard, tell us a little more about him. He had many accomplishments.
Well, Reverend Jackson is very important in the sense that he really was an accomplished person, not in the service class that Tom referenced. He was a town crier. He had been in New Bedford. He had been a minister, business person, had really, I won't say accumulated wealth, but I think he was a person of means. And he owned his cottage. His daughter owned the cottage, and they collectively owned it, you know, well over 50 years. And he really is one who began to talk about the campground ownership issues, but before, and then ultimately what happened there with some of the displacement of Blacks. But I want to go back to Tom's earlier point. Mm-hmm. The service class, the maids, the cooks, the chauffeurs, they began to buy land and property here unfettered by the racism on the mainland of America. And I think for two reasons. One, the people they were working for thought it was important for them to have stabilized housing. That way the service would be guaranteed. And also, we were not coming to the island in what I would call, for lack of a better word, overwhelming numbers. So there was some comfort in land ownership, at least for those two purposes. Tom, you may want to go further into the campgrounds. What happened there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Martha's Vineyard is known for the camp meeting in Oak Bluffs. And originally, there were homes owned by Black families in the camp meeting between 1887
yes.
and 1914. Homes owned by
right.
Blacks were relocated, right, and then removed from the
That's
camp.
Right.
So, Tom, tell us a little bit what was happening to Black homeowners at that time.
Okay. In the campground, Blacks and Native Americans were allowed to buy a house or to build a house on the campground, but the Camp Meeting Association made it clear from the beginning and they still do this today, that they own the actual land and they are only leasing the property to someone who builds a house there. So what happened was Blacks and Natives were allowed to build property, build houses there, but then at the end, toward the end of the 19th century, between about 1890 and 1914, a number of Blacks were told basically that their lease had expired and they had to move off the campground. And they did that. They didn't really have any choice because the Camp Meeting Association had their lease. And so when the lease was denied, then they had to move out. That was the tipping point between Richard and me, that we realized this was a very unjust situation that we wanted to address. It wasn't the sole topic, but it was sort of the thing that got us started. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want to dwell on it, but we wanted to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. So there were about 30 families that were moved off the campground, and we followed up on this fellow who had done research on it, and we were able to establish a little bit of a background of what happened to them, but we don't know individually where they ended up.
And you're talking about Andrew Patch, documentation. He documented, there's documentation of the systemic removal of Black-owned homes from the camp. That was only recently unearthed, right? So tell us a little bit more about the research of Andrew Patch and what documents he found.
Well, he was going over, he was the president of the board there, head of the board there of the Camp Meeting Association. And he's a lawyer from the Washington, D.C. area. And my guess is he was just going over the paperwork and the boxes of material like a new leader would do. And he uncovered this information that had been buried there for decades. And we say in the book, we give him a lot of credit for disclosing it. Mm-hmm. Some people might well have kept it immersed, hidden it, never to be revealed again. So we give him praise for the disclosure, and there is in fact a marker now on the property listing all of the family names. Now, in contrast, today, I've talked to a number of Black homeowners there in the Camp Meeting Association, and they believe the numbers are between 20 and 30 now, which is astonishing. A total of some 300 cottages are there. And we are now in the process of documenting those families so we can tell a complete story of the Camp Meeting Association, mm-hmm. then and now.
Okay. As we mentioned at the top of the show, there were many practices used in our country to deny Black Americans home ownership opportunities. Describe some of those practices and if they were also used on the vineyard.
A very good question. And this, too, got our juices going with respect to the writing. In many cities, as a response to the Great Migration in America, African Americans moving from south to north in large numbers, there was a very concerted conspiracy, if you will, between lawyers, real estate brokers, insurance agents, and banks to limit where Blacks could buy property. And this was done through redlining, blockbuster, and restrictive ordinances. For an example, in some cities, if you had a house with 10 houses on it in a block, if it was 6 houses owned by whites, it would become a white block, or 6 houses owned by Blacks, it'd be a Black block. That was the law until 1917. And Buchanan versus Worley was a Supreme Court case that outlawed restrictive ordinances. Then the racism just moved to private contracting, and you had racial restricted covenants in deeds. That was the law of the land until 1948, when a case called Shelley versus Kramer outlawed them. But through research that Tom did at Dukes County Registry, we discovered that there were some restrictive covenants in West Chop, and also by a developer by the name of Mr. Savage. But in addition to that, there was eminent domain. The most visible case of that has been Manhattan Beach, where in the 1920s they took over this Black resort just to make it a park because they could. Mm. And then subsequently, you may have read about it, the family was given some $20 plus million by the County of Los Angeles. So all of these tools, if you will, discriminatory tools, were used on the mainland, but to a less extent, significantly less extent, on the vineyard.
Yeah. Tom, who were some of the early Black vineyarders who were determined to purchase property despite some of these racist practices?
One of them was Phoebe Ballou, who was not quite a servant class, but she was a baker. She was working to bake bread for a local bakery, and she was able to purchase a duplex building down right on Oak Bluffs Harbor. And she stayed there, and then half of the house, the other part of the duplex, was owned by Dorothy West's family. And so the two families shared the house for a while, and then it burned, unfortunately, in 1909. And both people, Phoebe Ballou and Isaac West, were able to purchase another property, or they each got a new piece of property right in Oak Bluffs. And Phoebe Ballou was able to hold on to that property and pass it on to generations of her family. And one of her descendants was Louis Malo Jones, who was a very prominent African-American artist. And Isaac West had a house up on Myrtle Avenue, and his daughter was Dorothy West, who was the youngest member of the Harlem Renaissance, and then came back to Martha's Vineyard and was able to buy property, was able to write in Oak Bluffs.
Yeah, everybody's heard of Dorothy West, that's for sure. We're talking with Richard Lewis Taylor and Tom Dresser about their book, Black Home Ownership on Martha's Vineyard, A History, and we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the book, Black Home Ownership on Martha's Vineyard, A History, with co-authors Richard Lewis Taylor and Tom Dresser. Nationally, when did we start to see changes in the law removing barriers to home ownership? And did those changes encourage more Black vineyarders to purchase property on the vineyard?
No, I think they were unrelated. I think what attracted people in ever-increasing numbers here was the climate, the racial climate, the climate of comfort and acceptance and belonging. My cottage was purchased by my family in 1979 here. And it was purchased from an African-American family from Chicago. And so I say to myself, how can someone from Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Washington, all those cities come? The place has been very special. Some of the history that we've uncovered, the families we've uncovered, have all given rise to what we now have, an institution. The Cottages is a women's organization, African-American women's organization, 100 strong with a waiting list. One of the reasons, one of the criteria for joining is you must own a cottage. You have the African-American Film Festival. You have the Charles Ogletree Forums. You have the Comedy Fest. You have various book events here. All of these things, not to mention the what I call in subsequent years, the Brooke effect, and then of course the latest is the Obama effect. So all of these things have brought a sense of belonging. People know they're not a visitor here. They come, they bring their children. My grandchildren are coming here now. And it's really a large family, Black and white.
Yeah. When did we start to see more of a community of Black Americans on the vineyard? When did it seems like there's such a history here, and including Black-owned businesses. Talk a little bit where that started.
I think it started in the mid-50s, during what I call the Ed Brooke era. There was some years earlier, which we would call kind of the Adam Clayton Powell era. The Powell family fished, and they came to share a cottage. And Adam bought a cottage here in 1936, which is still in the family possession. But Ed Brooke was a Howard University graduate. Howard produces the largest number of African-American college graduates. And many bought cottages here. And he, among others, Linky Pope, was a founder of the Oak Bluffs Tennis Club. So we used to have a big Labor Day tennis tournament. So as I was trying to say, organizations and institutions and events really began to create the community. So I would say the late 50s, early 60s is when the community really expanded.
Yeah. Tommy,
in a significant way, and has grown evolutionary since then.
Yeah. Tommy, you want to add?
Adding to that, the Ebony Magazine in 1947 really promoted Oak Bluffs as an African-American vacation land. And that was sort of a stepping stone for what Richard just said about Ed Brooke coming here and becoming part of the community and raising the prominence of Oak Bluffs and of Martha's Vineyard. So there were a number of things that sort of fed together in it.
Yeah. We should add, I'm sorry, just in that same question though, Tom, don't forget we did a piece on the Green Book. Remember, the Green Book was a book that put in travel locations all around the country where Black people could come and feel comfortable. The Vineyard had 10 or 11 of those locations. Mm-hmm. So for long periods of time, people have felt comfortable coming here with places to stay and eat and enjoy.
Yeah. You both talked with legacy Black families about the significance of their vineyard property for themselves and their families. What were some of the common themes you heard in those conversations?
Well, when I asked Jocelyn Coleman Walton to do the foreword for this book, because her story is just, it's sort of emblematic of Black families that called the Vineyard home, even though it's just a summer community, it's home for them. And they have to go at the end of the season, they go back to their cities or urban areas or wherever, but they call the Vineyard home. And she started coming here shortly after she was born in 1938, I believe. And she started coming like when she was 2 years old because her grandmother worked here as in the summer as a nanny or a housekeeper. And she was able to put together a few dollars and was able to buy a small house in the Highlands. And Jocelyn had four siblings. And so the five of them would come down with their grandmother every year for the summer. And the kids grew up with the Highlands family supporting them. They could go downtown to hang out on Circuit Avenue. They would go to the Inkwell and swim and just enjoy the whole summer experience. And over the years, Jocelyn's grandfather came down with the family too. And after a few years of staying with with the family there, he said, you know, why do we always come to the same house? All these things that are wrong with it. And that's when his wife had to admit that she had bought the house. And
that's so funny.
It became sort of a lifelong story of just owning property was just what pulled everything together. Yeah. So Jocelyn's now in her 80s, and she's got children and grandchildren that enjoy the vineyard and siblings that still come here and stuff. So it's really become a family experience. And just to show that her grandfather was not just worried about the house, he was also known as the Black theater leader in Boston, because he, during the Roosevelt administration, during the Depression, he was in charge of pulling together all the Black theater projects in the city.
Let me add, though, I think the overriding on that same point, Black Americans live with what has been defined in 1903 by W.B. Du Bois as this world of double consciousness. You live in a white world, you live in a Black world. When you come to the Vineyard, that veil, if you will, of double consciousness is lifted off. And you come, you enjoy, and you get restored energy to go back and fight the racism on the other side. Yeah. So there is a mental, physical, and spiritual sense of freedom that is felt here. Okay. And the families who really understand that, spread that, and their children inherit that.
Yeah.
That's what makes this place special.
You know, which is so well said, and I'm just thinking, how do we get that to be everywhere else? How do we get people to take that?
Oh, boy.
Wouldn't that be nice?
In fairness, though, it's a bit of a Shangri-La in this sense. Mm-hmm. We don't have overcrowdedness. We do have housing costs that are permeate everywhere. We, among others, myself and others, are fighting food insecurity here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we really don't have the urban and rural complexities of life on the vineyard. And so while we enjoy it, it is very special mm-hmm. and very, very difficult to replicate on the mainland.
Yeah.
But we enjoy it for what it is and spread it to our subsequent families.
Yeah.
One thing that Richard came up with that I wish we'd thought of earlier is that years ago, there were two mailboxes in front of the Oak Bluffs post office. And there's still two mailboxes there. But years ago, they had different labels on them. One said Island Mail. The other one said America and Beyond. And that characterizes what we feel about Martha's Vineyard.
That's right.
It's special here, whoever we are, wherever we are on the vineyard, but then there's America over there that we have to deal with.
Yeah. What surprises did you find? I imagine Andrew Patch's stuff was surprising, but what did you have anything in the research that really surprised you?
Yeah, the restrictive covenants in West Chop and this guy Savage, the development deal he did. We didn't really know. I didn't think there were many here at all. And Tom went up to the Dukes County Registry. And you would expect just normally to have some discriminatory tools used here. You would expect that. But they were rare. There were exceptions. And there was no mass conspiracy. I would say that.
Mm-hmm.
There were other families that we found up in Aquinnah and other families in other parts of the island other than Oak Bluffs that was also not so much a surprise, but we were able to document. And finally, on my point, the number one real estate broker on Martha's Vineyard is an African-American woman, Jennifer DeSilva. And I asked her, I said, tell me about the spread, if you will, of where people are buying homes. She said in 2023, of the 20 plus homes that I sold, only half were in Oak Bluffs. The other half were spread around the island, and Edgartown was the most popular.
Hmm.
That was a surprise. Good to know.
Yeah. Tom, what about for you?
From my perspective, just looking at American history in the post-Civil War era, the whole issue of Jim Crow laws and prejudice was nationwide. You look at the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson and how racial discrimination was just part of the culture, unfortunately, through that late 19th century time. And we did not escape it. The whole campground experience was an example of what was going on all across America. So I feel that the Camp Meeting Association, while they are, it was bad what happened, we're unhappy with it, the way we are today is just so much different. Like Richard said, there's something like 30 families that are Black that now have property on the Camp Meeting, in the Camp Meeting Association. I've met the director there. She's just trying to do as much as she can for promoting Black home ownership. She spoke at the annual reading of the Frederick Douglass speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July, and they held it at the Tabernacle. She had a flag raising for the African-American community on Juneteenth. I mean, she's making an effort, and we feel that we're much more together. The African American Heritage Trail recognized the whole situation from the late 1800s with the big plaque. So I think the community has come together. I'm impressed with the unity of the community toward the Black situation, if you will. So
Oh, I did mention, just you asked the question earlier about Black businesses. C'est La Vie, which is in a clothing store on Circuit Ave, is owned by an African-American, very busy. Cousin Rose Gallery, a little further down on Circuit Ave, is owned by an African-American proprietor. And Ronnie's, Fat Ronnie's Burgers, all minority businesses on Circuit Ave, but they own their property. And that's key, because we've seen businesses come and go when they rent, because someone always ups the rent. Yeah. They build a brand and then they get pushed out. So owning real estate for businesses here has been important.
Yeah. The book is titled Black Home Ownership on Martha's Vineyard, A History, co-authored by Tom Dresser and Richard Lewis Taylor. We'll post a link with more information about the book and your upcoming book talks at our website, capeandislands.org. Richard Lewis Taylor and Tom Dresser, thanks so much for being with us and for writing the book. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Good. Thanks, Mindy.
Coming up after a break, the Provincetown Jazz Festival.